that unbroken supersymmetry imposes constraints on this tensor fields. So unbroken supersymmetry implies, so first of all, for the M-theory case, M-theory on Calabi-Yau four folds, well, that certain components of the tensor fields have to vanish. The 4-0 component, the 0-4 component, 3-1, and 1-3 components all have to vanish. And the only non-vanishing component is R2-2 component, which has to be primitive. This means for this case that wedge J has to be equal to 0. Now, these conditions, we derive them from the supersymmetry constraints, or I mentioned how one can derive them from the supersymmetry constraints. And we discussed that they can be obtained also from two superpotentials that were W is equal to F wedge, the holomorphic 4-0 form, and W tilde, that is the tensor field, the 4 form, which the killer form square. So then, what else? Then we talked about the type 2B case. So this was M-theory in a 4-fold. Then we talked about the type 2B case. Type 2B on Calabi-Yau 3-folds. And we saw that unbroken supersymmetry implies that the flux is imaginary self-dual. This means that we have a complex 3-form. This is equal to I times G3. And unbroken supersymmetry, moreover, demands the zeros 3 part of the flux to be equal to 0. Okay. Now, these conditions we discussed can be obtained from a superpotential that is equal to the holomorphic 3-form times G3. Again, G3 is the complex 3-form of the type 2B theory, so it's given by the sum of, so G3 is the sum of the Ramon-Ramon 3-form and the Nevers-Schwarz. 3-form tau is the action-Dilaton combination. So the superpotentials are closely related to potentials, to scalar potentials. They are related to scalar potentials for the moduli fields, right? For things like this tau parameter of the torus, so as we discussed last time. So as a result, once these fluxes acquire non-vanishing expectation values, so we no longer have all these flux directions. We are still left with a few flux directions, but not as many as before. So, and this is good in the search for the ground set of string theory. Now, what I didn't do last time, and I should have done, is to give a few references of all the stories references. So let me give you a list of papers and lectures that are relevant. So the M-theory story. The M-theory story can be found in an old paper of ours. So the supersymmetric conditions are in this paper over here. So these are the supersymmetric conditions on the fluxes. And then later on we discussed a few solutions that solve the questions of motion by Bragg supersymmetry in this paper over here. So solutions, let me just say, solutions that break supersymmetry. Now, the two superpotentials, W and W tilde over here, can be found in a paper by Gukovafa and Witten. So, W and, let me call this W tilde, are found in paper by Gukovafa and Witten. The HEPTH number is 1996070. Now, I also mentioned, even though I didn't discuss it in detail, that the superpotentials can be obtained from a Kaluza-Klein reduction. Now, of M-theory on 4-folds, so the Kaluza-Klein reduction can be found in a paper of ours, Huck and Lewis. Or in a paper by Huck and Lewis. So, so you can find the numbers, the pH numbers of these in spires. Now, what else? Where's my eraser here? For the type to be story, it's mainly based on a paper by Giddings, Kafel, and Korczynski. So type to be stories based on Giddings, Kafel, and Korczynski. And let's see, the pH number is 0105097. Now, moreover, the relation between or the explicit chain of string dualities that you need to transform the M3 backgrounds into type 2B backgrounds can be found in a paper by Dasgupta, Ragish, and Zeti. So, let's see, duality between 2B and M3 backgrounds. So this is found in, again, Dasgupta, Rajesh, and Zeffi, and the number is 9908088. Good. Now, what else? There are some lectures I actually like very much about complex manifolds that are very good, also a very good introduction to Calabi-Yau's. So these are lectures by Candelas. So if you can get these, they are very good. So Candelas. They are called lectures on complex manifolds. So, and they are found in the proceedings of the Trieste Spring School 1987 proceedings of Trieste Spring School 1987. Good. Now, so today's and tomorrow's lectures will be based first of all, on an older paper by Strominger, Superstring Fifth Torsion. And now I once again lost my eraser. So today's tomorrow's lectures are based on, first of all, again, Superstring Fifth Torsion. So this is an older paper by Strominger, and so this is a pre-HPH era, so it's a nuclear physics B 274, 1986, 253. And on several papers that I've written recently, mainly in collaboration with Melanie Becker, Keshav Dasgupta, Eric Sharp, and Paul Green. So several papers with M. Becker, Keshav Dasgupta, Eric Sharp, mainly with Eric Sharp and Paul Green. Oh, without B. Okay, yeah. Oh, and of course there are the standard textbooks. I mean, you know this all, right? So there are standard textbooks. So there's, of course, Green, Schwartz, and Witten. 1 and 2. And there is Kwaczynski's book for some basic material. Now, at this point, I like to use the opportunity to make a small commercial. Actually, we are writing an additional book that is going to come out this year. So the title is String Theory and M Theory, a Modern Primer. And M theory, a modern primer. So this is a book that I'm writing together with Melanie and John Schwartz. And again, it's going to appear this year in Cambridge University Press. All right, so far so good. So today I would like, as I mentioned, I would like to discuss flux compactifications of the heterotic string. So fluxes, let me call this today's lecture, fluxes, torsion, and heterotic strings. So it turns out, so today we are going to talk about the role of fluxes in the heterotic string. It turns out that for the case yesterday, we talked about type 2B, and we saw that there is the complex 3 from G3 that I also mentioned a moment ago. For the case of the heterotic, there's only one real 3 from H. So there is only one real 3 from H. So once H acquires a non-vanishing expectation value, there are several implications for the background geometry. So first of all, the space-time becomes warped. This time or acquires a non-vanishing warp factor. Acquires a non-vanishing or non-constant warp factor. So what this means is the following. Usually, in order to make contact between string theory and the real world, we assume that we have some space-time that is given by a product, and that's by a direct product like this. So we have 10 dimensions. This can be 4 dimensions times an interior manifold that we usually assume to be small and compact. But it turns out that this is not the most general ansatz. But what can happen is that a warp factor has to be included, and then the metric of space-time will look something like this. E to the 2, so this is the metric in the Einstein frame, 10-dimensional Einstein frame that looks in this way. Maybe I should put it on the next blackboard. It's a bigger formula. So the 10-dimensional metric in the Einstein frame takes a form like this. So x are the coordinates of the external space, and y the ones of the internal space. So we can have a scalar function. So, 0, 0, gmn of y. So this over here is what is called, it's a scalar function, and it's what is called the warp factor. So this a metric like this is still allowed by the symmetries in our problem. So this is the external spacetime metric, external spacetime, and this is the internal manifold. So it's no longer a direct product, but we can have a function depending on the coordinates of the internal manifold. Only supersymmetry will require this function to be non-constant. So supersymmetry will require so d to be non-constant. And actually, I haven't discussed this for the M3 and the type 2B cases yesterday, but a function like this also appears for those cases. But we are going to talk about it more in detail today. So the second consequence of having a non-vanishing edge is that the spacetime acquires torsion. So, the spacetime acquires torsion. So, what this means is that the torsion tensor is defined as something like this. It's the difference. What this practically means is that the Christoffel symbols are no longer symmetric under the interchange of the lower indices. So something like this is going to become non-vanishing. So this quantity over here is called torsion. And it can be shown that as opposed to the Christoffel symbols, this thing is a tensor. This is a tensor. A tensor. So since it's a tensor, it has intrinsic geometric meaning. So let's talk a little bit about what that is. And let me come up with an example. So again, I don't want to give any general definitions over here, but I would like to illustrate the different ideas by coming up with different examples. So, example. So let's consider the two-dimensional plane, just R2. So R2 over here, this is X and this is Y. And well, we can define parallel transport in the sense of elementary geometry, right? So we can define parallel transport in the sense of elementary geometry, right? I mean, like we all know how to do this, elementary geometry. So this means that if we have, for example, a vector over here, we parallel transport it infinitesimally in this direction, then it may end up over here. And if we take a vector over here, we parallel transport it to the right, we obtain a vector over there, and the resulting parallelogram is going to close, right? So the resulting parallelogram closes. Well, so far so good. This implies that what we have done is we have used the Christoffel connection that is torsion free. So we have used the torsion free Christoffel connection. And each time we are given one metric, there is a unique way to say what this torsion-free Christoffel connection, how it looks like. So if we take the flat metric, it's just equal to zero. We can also take, for example, polar coordinates. And then we would get a Christoffel or a one-form connection in polar coordinates. Well, we would get are one form, a connection one form given by Define. The Christopher symbols would not be equal to zero, but we still would have a vanishing torus, and so we are still going to get a closed parallelogram. But now it turns out we can also choose. We can choose any connection that is compatible with a metric. So what this means is that we can actually use any connection that is going to leave the metric covariantly constant. And it turns out that for our simple example, we can, for example, choose a connection one form. This means that we can choose any connection that looks in this way. Alpha beta is equal to a one form times the Pauli metric sigma two, alpha beta. Well, it turns out that this thing and this H is any one form, and this is actually a good homework exercise for you, any one form. And we can, for example, choose H to be a constant. A times one minus X squared dx, just for a matter of making things concrete. And then so this is a nice homework exercise for you. So, for example, that this is going to leave the metric covariantly constant. So this is an allowed choice for a connection. And so what is this? And it turns out that this has, so this leads to a non-vanishing torsion. So this leads to a non-vanishing torsion. So, and it's actually easy to see that by using this connection, the parallel transport is going to be changed, and parallelograms fail to close. So you define parallel transport by using this connection, and you look at your small parallelogram again. And what is going to happen is that if you have a vector over here, you move it along the y-axis. Well, you get the vector, the same vector over here. But if you take this vector over here and you move it to the right, then it's going to be rotated a little bit by an angle that we can't control by the choice of A. So as a result, this infinitesimal parallelogram fails to close. Infinitesimal parallelogram fails to close. So, and again, this is a nice homework exercise. Show that the thing over here is compatible with the metric. Well, so this is the general rule. So different choices of connection, and especially things that are going to have torsion, are going to give you different rules for defining parallel transport. So this sounds all well and nice, but what are we going to do with that, right? So again, the thing, torsion as opposed to the Christoffel symbols is a tensor. And actually, gravity theories with torsion have a long history. They have been invented as far back as 1922 by Cartan. Gravity theories with torsion. Gravity theories with torsion have been considered first 1922 by Cartan. And again, I mean, he recognized that, well, a Riemann tensor, so things coupled to the metric, to curvature, for example, well, why shouldn't there be things that couple to torsion? Well, nowadays we are string theorists, and we are going to see that we have tensors that naturally have three indices and are anti-symmetric, right? The tensor fields of the heterotic, for example. And we are going to see that that actually plays the role of torsion. You may wonder, well, have we seen something that couples to torsion in the world around us? Well, in some sense. I mean, because you can say, for example, what if we take a three form in four dimensions? So what is it going to couple? Well, a free form, if we are in, let's say, free space-like dimensions, is going to be dual to what is called a pseudo-scalar. So let me give a quick reminder about what pseudo-tensors are. So short intro to pseudo-tensors. Well, we all know what a tensor is, right? So we know that if we make a change of the coordinates, for example, we go from one set of coordinates xi to a new set of coordinates x prime that are functions of the old coordinates, then a scalar or rank zero tensor is not going to change. A vector is going to change according to certain rules, right? We all know this. A prime is equal to xi prime. Xj, Aj, so it can transform in this way, a contravariant tensor, a covariant tensor, and so on. So we can define this thing over here. Let me call this constant Ij. And so so this is a vector. We can define rank two tensors. Well, pseudo tensors are going to transform almost in the same way. In the same way as tensors, but there's going to be an additional factor of a determinant. So, pseudo-scalars, for example, yes. Over here. So, well, in this way, or the other way, right? Okay, whatever. What? I don't hear the acoustics over here. Oh. Yes, okay, whatever. Yeah, sure. That's okay. Yeah, you're right. Absolutely. Yes, so we have vectors, we have rank two tensors, and so on. So in the case that we talk about pseudo tensors, we are going to get additional factors depending on the determinant. So we have a pseudo scalar. This is the determinant of Ij. And then, for example, if we use a reflection in three dimensions, we are going to get an additional sign, right? So if we use a reflection, reflection in three dimensions, right? X prime is equal to minus xi, we get an additional sign. Minus sign. Okay, so well, this is a pseudo scalar, and things like this in four dimensions are going to couple to torsion as well as to the metric. So in the world around us, things like torsion are most probably not going to have any effect for a theory of gravity, the only thing that we are going to see curvature. But in the following, we are going to see that if we are interested in a microscopic theory of gravity, then understanding the role of torsion is actually crucial. So let's talk about the conditions for unbroken supersymmetry. So unbroken supersymmetry in heterotic strings. All right. So for the case of heterotic strings, we have several kind of fermionic fields. Well, we have our gravitino that is going to transform in the following way: covariant derivative acting on the infinitesimal spinor minus 1/4 curly h m and epsilon equal to 0. Again, this curly things are given by 1 divided by 2 factorial, so by the contraction with the gamma matrices, PQ. we have a gravitino, we have a dilatino, this last phi acting on epsilon, minus 1/2, again, the contraction of H with the gamma matrices, and we are going to demand that this is equal to 0, and we have a gluino, delta chi is equal to 1/2 times, again, the contraction of the two-form Young-Mills field, and this is going to be equal to 0. So, again, we have a three-form, a real three-form. We have over here a Young-Mills field. And what else do we have? We have a dilaton over here, phi dilaton. So these are the supersymmetry transformations in the 10-dimensional string frame. Good. So now I'm switching from the Einstein frame to the string frame. Where did it go now? So the three form of the heterotic string satisfies the Bianchi identity. DH is equal to alpha prime over 4 trace of R with R minus trace of F with F, right? Okay, we will be interested in solutions that have Poincaré invariance in the external space-time. And as a result, we are going to set some components of the fields equal to 0. So Poincaré invariance implies, well, that H with external components are equal to F with external components is equal to 0. So most of the time we are going to talk about compactifications to 4 space-time dimensions, even though the analysis is quite general, and a bit later I will present examples that are compactifications to 6 dimensions. So any kind of even dimensional internal manifolds are actually in principle allowed. So any kind of even dimensional internal manifolds are allowed. Manifolds will be considered. So, now, so what this means practically is that we want a space, an external one that is homogeneous and isotropic, so we don't want to single out any points or any directions in the external space-time. So this is the reason why these components are equal to 0, and the rest of the fields are only allowed to depend on the coordinates of the internal manifold. So far, so good. So what can we do? We want to solve the supersymmetry transformations, and where there is one consistent set of solutions. So if we said, for example, so one way to solve this is to say, well, everything involving H is going to be equal to 0. The dilaton is going to be a constant, and the covariant derivative of epsilon is going to be equal to 0. Well, these are the ordinary Calabi-Yau compactifications. So one set of solutions is setting H is equal to 0. We are setting the covariant derivative of the spinner equal to 0, and we are using a dilaton that is constant. Well, again, these are Calabi-Yau compactifications. So in the following, we will be interested in looking at solutions that have non-vanishing H. So let's look, for example, at this equation. So this over here, if H vanishes, these are these are Calabi-Yau compactifications. And the following use H not equal to zero. We would like to consider H not equal to zero. So why do we want to do that? Well, the first lecture was a motivation. We had the good experience of looking at the M-theory backgrounds and type 2B backgrounds, and we saw that if we have tensor fields, right, then things like moduli fields are going to get some potentials. And so we are going to try the same thing now for this kind of backgrounds obtained from the terotic string. And we want to see if maybe H can also lead to potentials for moduli fields. But before we can do that, we are going to see that we have to study a whole new story about the kind of backgrounds that we have, because H is going to act as torsion. So that in case that we have non-vanishing H, the space acquires torsion can actually be easily seen from the variation of the gravitino. So remember that. So let me maybe leave that on the blackboard over here. So from the gravitino variation, delta psi m is equal to m epsilon minus 1/4 and h m acting on epsilon equal to zero, we can see that H acts as torsion. So we actually just have to write down the definition of the covariant derivative of the spinner to see that. So we know that consider first the case, so again, we know the definition. We had this yesterday, but let me repeat it. So dm acting on epsilon is the ordinary derivative. And then we have this term containing the spin connection, 1/4 omega, oops, a omega abm, gamma ab acting on epsilon. Okay. So now it turns out that if there is no torsion, then so if the torsion, if t is equal to zero, we can express the spin connection through the Christoffer symbol. So let me write the result for this, through the inverse Philbin dm and the Christoffer symbol, something like this, mn. Now. We decided that we want to have non-vanishing H over here. So as a result, what we are going to do is to shift the spin connection by an amount like this. So we are going to shift the spin connection. According to 1/2 H AB m that is equal to 1/2 the Philbin and the inverse Philbin h l n m. So to cut a long story short, what we are going to do is to add this thing over here, or to define an effective Christoffer symbol, right, where we are going to add this thing that is symmetric and this thing that is anti-symmetric under the interchange of the lower indices. So as a result, by definition, this is torsion. So H, from here we see that H, and let me write this as an upper index, L and M, acts as an effective torsion, or as torsion. So we can define a new covariant derivative that will be given by the torsion-free connection plus H. Again? Oh, well, yeah, the inverse. Okay, yeah, I'm changing up a bit the notation with respect to yesterday. Okay. So, again, effectively what we are doing is we are adding this term to the spin connection, and this is going to act effectively as a Christoffel symbol that is anti-symmetric. So we can define a new covariant derivative. Let me call this, nabla tilde acting on epsilon. So this is the derivative defined with respect to the connection without torsion, minus 1/4 hm. Acting on epsilon. Good. And again, the new connection has the new connection has non-vanishing torsion. Good. So this is one of the first properties that we learn of the background. So let's see what else can we learn. So from now on we will be working with this with this tilde derivative over here. So so the gravitational transformations have several components. So we have several components in the supersymmetric transformation. So now I would like to discuss the properties of the different kind of spaces that we have. Well, first of all, we can have the external component of the gravitational, right? So here we have the gravitational supersymmetric transformation. We decided that if H has an index in the external space time, this thing is going to vanish. So, I mean, this one is easy to solve. Psi mu is equal to d mu epsilon, and this is equal to zero. So, as a result, we can obtain the condition that, by squaring this, by computing the derivative of the thing, so we get the condition that the scalar curvature of the external space-time has to vanish. But now remember that we are interested in this homogeneous and isotropic solutions. This means that we can only have either De Sitter space, anti-De Sitter space, or Minkowski space. Well, De Sitter space cannot be a solution because it doesn't allow supersymmetry. Anti-De Sitter space, so then we would have over here a constant, but this equation is telling us that the external space is Minkowski space. So the external space is Minkowski. Good, so we solved for that one already, but what we would like to do in the following is to find out properties of the internal space-time. Again, all the solutions were, one can claim, well, yes, we have shown that the cosmological constant of the external space-time is equal to zero. So these are not solutions of any cosmological constant problem, simply because these are still supersymmetric solutions. And even if in the last day's lecture we talked about solutions with a vanishing cosmological constant and a broken supersymmetry, there's still no reason why statements like this should be protected against correction. So, I mean, one should be careful before claiming any relation to a solution of the cosmological constant problem. So, so the external space is Minkowski. So the next thing we want to do is to obtain conditions on the internal dimensions. So, let's see. We have as a result, since this is Minkowski, we have a space time that looks in this way. So, a metric over here, zero. Good. So the question is, so what is this? So what are the properties of the internal dimensions? So, by the way, are there any questions? Yes, okay, good. not true. Well, yes, but you have to be careful that you're going to, for example, if you have type 2B, then you're going to run into a complex reform, and then you're going to have over here something like epsilon star. So there you must be careful. Maybe you can do it for type 2A, yes, but you should be careful with the stars. Each time the things are complex. More questions? Yes. Excuse me? So yeah, let me, so what I would, so this is the Einstein frame metric. So it turns out, okay, yeah, good question. So I skipped a step. The warp factor is actually related to the dilaton. So, and this follows actually. So this warp factor D is related to phi. And then when I transform from the Einstein frame to the string frame, this, the thing disappears. More questions? Good. So, so properties of the internal dimension. So what do we know? We know that, so we want to set the internal component of the gravitational transformation equal to zero. So as a result, so let me call this properties, please. Of the internal dimensions. So, first of all, again, we want to set the internal component of the gravitational transformation equal to zero. So this means that we can find spinors, two spinors of opposite chirality that are covariantly constant with respect to our new connection over here, the connection with torsion, right? Because we want to set that thing, that derivative equal to zero. So follows from delta psi m is equal to zero. Got it. So this means that if we define a scalar quantity, the scalar quantity eta dagger plus minus, eta plus minus, simply will be constant. So as a result, we can choose this constant to be one, right? So we act on it with a derivative, so it's a scalar quantity, and it's going to be constant, so we set the constant equal to one. So the next thing we can do is to define a tensor, and then we are going to derive properties of this tensor. So, so we can define a tensor. Define a tensor in the following way. So J, and then a bit later we are going to see what this tensor actually is. Dagger gamma mn or gamma matrices times times eta plus. Now it can be shown, and this is a homework exercise again for you, so I don't want to go into the computation, that this tensor has the property, so this or J has the property, J has the property that J squared is equal to minus one. So this is a homework exercise for you, homework. And you can show that by using what is called Peart's rearrangement. So these are a definite set of rules, and you can use that to show that the thing is squares to one. So the hint to solve this homework is, so show this, show star. By using Peart's rearrangements. Peart's rearrangements. Good, yes. These are commuting spinners, yes. So because they are defined on the internal space time. So, shall this using filter arrangement, so where's my eraser? Now, so because of the existence of a spinner that set, of a form of a tensor field that satisfies this, the manifold is what is called almost complex. So in the following, so the internal manifold is almost complex. So in the following, I will use a few definitions from mathematics. So this is what is called an almost complex manifold. So the manifold is called almost complex and J is an almost complex structure. Moreover, and here's homework exercise number two, once again using filter arrangements, you can show that, so homework number two, use filter arrangements to show that the metric satisfies this condition over here, MK, J, NL. GKL. This means that the metric is Hermitian. Yes, there was a question. Again? What is with eta minus? Yeah. So in the following, we are only working with eta plus. So if you have additional ones, then you may end up with an additional amount of supersymmetry. You may be talking, for example, about if this would be Keller, for example, about hyperkeller things where you have several complex structures and so on. So this is not. So we want to consider only one of these. Only one. Okay. So now. So the metric satisfies this condition over here. This means it's Hermitian. Again, this is something that you can show using filter arrangement. So you use the definition of J of this tensor field, and again, this is a homework exercise. Now, this implies that so we can define a two-form, the tensor first of all. Define the tensor. J Mn is equal to GMK GKn times the metric. So, and you can actually show by contracting with GKM that the thing is anti-symmetric. So it defines a natural two form. JMN is equal to minus JNM. So this defines a natural two form. Good. So this defines a natural two form. So there are different conventions on how this thing should be called. Some people just call it two form. Other people call it the fundamental form. And other people, and this is the most confusing notation, call it a Keller form, even though the thing does not describe a Keller manifold. So let's simply call the thing a fundamental form. Fundamental form. Good. So this is a natural two form, and for the case that the thing is closed, so if dj is equal to zero, this is a Keller manifold. So for the case that it's closed, it would be a Keller manifold. But for the present case, so we are going to see that the J is not equal to zero. So we are going to see that the manifold is actually non-Keller. So, but for the present case, DJ is not equal to zero, so the background is non-Keller. Is non-Keller. So as we are going to see in a moment. So, and here is where our trouble starts, right? Yes. Excuse me? Wait. So at this moment, we are at the point where we have shown that it's an almost complex manifold. We have J squared equal to minus one. It's Hermitian, but now we have to, first of all, we have to show that it's a complex manifold, right? This is the next thing. But the comment I was making over here is that if you can show that it's a complex manifold with DJ is equal to zero, then we would be talking about a Keller manifold. But this is not the case for what we are considering over here. So I wanted to stress that. So this is the two form that is going to lead to a Keller form, for example, if we are working with Calabi-Yau's. But for the present case, we are going to see a bit later that DJ is not equal to zero. So, and again, this is where our trouble starts. We see that the background action of the fluxes on the geometry is so strong that so the internal dimensions are going to acquire torsion. They are going to become non-Keller, and actually these are spaces about which not much is known, not from the mathematical or from the physics point of view. So they are very difficult, I mean, as opposed to Calabi-Yau manifolds. So these backgrounds come closer to the real world. Again, there are compactifications of the heterotic string to four dimensions, but at the same time, the internal dimensions become very, 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 very complicated. So let me argue for you, why these things are non-Keller, so why this is not equal to zero. Questions? Yes. Hold on. We are on the way. Hold on. More questions. The what? Hold on. Let me finish. Okay, good. So the next thing we want to do so is to complete the Nienhaus tensor, right? So okay. So we know that we have this nice covariant derivative, right? So so this is another homework exercise for you. So this one is not very difficult. So homework, these are things, again, I'm not going to check any formulas for you. I leave it for you to check that things like this over here are that things like this are true. So use supersymmetry to show that the covariant derivative with a torsional connection is given by a result like this. Now I have to be careful with my indices over here. Mn JSP is equal to zero. So it's possible to show using supersymmetry that the covariant derivative with respect to this torsional connection of J is equal to zero. So now we can use that to compute the Nienhaus tensor that the audience wants to hear about. Okay. So we want to use that covariant derivative to show that the manifold is complex. So so the question we want to ask is, can we find coordinates? So can we show that the manifold is complex? Manifold is complex. So this means, can we find a set of coordinates where we can use our almost complex, or we can put our complex structure in this form over here? So is this possible? Well, in order to answer this question, we have to compute the Nijinas tensor, and these components over there are equal to zero. So in order to answer the question if we can find coordinates where this is true, we have to show that the Nijinas tensor vanishes. So we want to compute some kind of tensor depending on J and the derivative of J. So the definition of this tensor is the following. M and P is equal, and I have to be careful that I don't scrub my indices. There are too many of them. J N P minus J N Q, the derivative J M P. So so the statement over here is that this tensor over here is going to vanish if and only if we can put the complex structure in this form over here. So that this is, I'm not going to prove the theorem that this is true. I'm only going to give a naive argument. So this is like asking, so when can we find, we are given some kind of space. So when can we find a metric that is flat? So when can we, for example, say that the metric is simply flat? Well, what we're going to do is to compute, we look at the metric and we compute tensors containing the derivative of the metric, like, for example, the Riemann tensor. So if the Riemann tensor vanishes, then we know that we can use a flat metric. So the question over here is, can we put the complex structure in this form over here? So in order to do that, we have to show that this vanishes. So it's of course true. I mean, what is trivial to show is that if this is the case, if J is of this form, this is going to vanish. I mean, that direction is clear. The one that's a little bit more difficult to prove is once this vanishes that you can put in that form, but I'm just going to assume this threshold. So, well, it turns out that we work very hard to get this result for the covariant derivative of J, and using that, it's possible to show this bunch. Good. So this means that we can use a complex structure that looks in this way over here. Questions? So we have our complex structure that is on this form. Supersymmetry implies that n is equal to zero. So this follows from supersymmetry. So we already have a few properties of our background. We know we have a complex manifold. We know that we are working with a torsional background, and let's see what else can we learn. So once we know that we are working with a complex structure that works, that looks in this way, we can relate our fundamental two form to the metric in the following way. So we define a two form as 1 divided by 2 factorial, jmp dxm with dxp. So, and now we can use the metric to raise and lower indices, J, M, N, G, N, P, X, M, watch the X, P. So, and now we can use the fact that this thing over here is given by this result over there. So this means that we get the result that this is I times the metric A, B bar, D, Z, A, watch D, Z, B bar. So this means that for the present case, this two form is closely related to the metric. Good. So J is given by this result over here. So what else? So there are a few additional properties of this background. And again, this thing. So if DJ is equal to zero, the background is scalar. But again, for the present case, this will be non-vanishing. Now, using again the derivative that we computed over there, it's possible to show that the result for H, and again, this is a good homework exercise, so that the result for H is given by I times D bar minus D times J, so where these are the double operators. Dj is given by dZa, with the derivative with respect to Za, and the same for the bar. D bar of J is equal to Z bar A bar, which A bar. So this means that, well, in general, again, H will be non-vanishing, and it is given by the derivative of this fundamental form. So let me mention a few additional properties of this background. So this is one piece of information. This is the result for H. Now, so what else? Remember that Calabi-Yau manifolds had first of all, they have a Keller form, but they also had this holomorphic N0 form, right? So we had an holomorphic 4-0 form for Calabi-Yau fourfolds, holomorphic 3-0 form for Calabi-Yau threefolds. Well, this kind of spaces also have a form like that. So supersymmetry implies, so unbroken supersymmetry. Implies the existence of a holomorphic N0 form. So this form satisfies the property. So again, it's an holomorphic form. And it's given by an expression like this. And again, this is something that you can show using the supersymmetry rules, eta minus transpose. Gamma A1, gamma AN, eta minus DZA1, blah, 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 DZAN. So N is going to be the complex dimension. So this means that, again, we are, of course, working with manifolds that are even dimensional. So this is half of the real dimension. So again, this is for Calabi-Yau manifolds. You would have a form. This holomorphic form would look exactly the same up to the factor over here, depending on the Dilaton. Now, supersymmetry implies that the norm of this form is related to the Dilaton. And again, supersymmetry implies that the norm is related to the Dilaton. It's 1/2 log of the norm of omega. Good. And one last piece of information that flows from supersymmetry that I would like to mention. Is that there is an equation relating the complex structure and omega that looks somehow like this. D of star J is equal to I D bar minus D on log omega, which can also be written in a form that I actually saw. This is the way it was written in Strominger's original paper. But actually a form that I find much nicer is the statement that we have a closed form. So it can be written in this form over here. So this is something that follows from, again, from supersymmetry. And now we are almost done for the conditions on the background. So we have talked about the metric of the external space, the metric on the internal space, and we still have to say something about, remember that we have a Young-Mills field, right? Well, the Young-Mills field, by using the solution for H that we derived over here, so the Young-Mills field is constrained to satisfy an equation like this. dd bar of j is equal to alpha prime divided by 8 trace of r, which r, minus trace f, which f. So over here we have the Young-Mills field and the Donaldson-Uhlenbeck, or an equation that for Keller background was solved by Donaldson-Uhlenbeck and Yao. So this one looks, the equation looks similar as for the Keller case. So this is the Donaldson-Uhlenbeck-Yau equation. Beck and Yau equation. So, and these are all the properties on the background that follow from supersymmetry. Remember that for Calabi-Yau compactifications, we used to do what is called embedding the spin connection to the gate connection. We used to set this equal to zero. Well, this is no longer the case because the left-hand side will be non-vanishing for this kind of background. So these are all the conditions one has to solve. And it actually, again, it turns out to be pretty hard to find explicit examples of this kind of torsional backgrounds with torsional backgrounds that are non-killer. Questions? Yes. Well, you can probably say if you use the plus sign over there, then you're probably going to use that they are complex conjugate, right? So now you must be careful with your, so you will probably consider the complex conjugate of that thing, something like this. So I don't think it's a big deal. More questions? Good. So then what I would like to do is, actually, these were the general conditions on the background. And what I would like to do in the next lecture is to discuss some explicit examples. So the first example will be a compactification of the heterotic string, not down to 4 dimensions, but down to 6 dimensions. And we are going to see that there is a simple set of solutions that are given by a scalar function times K3. And that example is very, very simple, and it can be solved in a closed form. And the next kind of examples that are compactifications to 4 dimensions. So the example I'm going to discuss will be in the orbifold limit. So it has turned out again to be really difficult to find examples away from the orbifold limit. So we are going to work with a chain of string dualities. We are going to start with the flux backgrounds for the type 2B string, and we are going to use a chain of string dualities to transform this into a torsional background for the heterotic. And again, finding examples away from the orbifold limit is almost impossible. Yes. That's a very good question we are working on. So let me maybe tell you a bit of a story. So remember that we talked, for example, yesterday about the existence of complex structure moduli and killer structure moduli, right? So in case that we are talking about a Calabi-Yau. So what this practically means is, well, if we are talking about a Calabi-Yau manifold, then we know that we have a background or a Ricci tensor depending on the metric that is equal to zero, right? So now we are going to ask the question, so how can we deform the metric G plus delta G so that we still get a Calabi-Yau, so we still want to import the condition that this is equal to zero. Now this can be transformed to a condition that is or to an equation that is called the Lichernowitz equation, right? Something like this. Now I have to be careful here with my indices. So R N P Q delta P Q GPQ is equal to zero. Now, for the case that we are working with a Kähler manifold, you can actually show, I mean, it's a bit of work, but you can do it, that this equation over here splits into equations for, first of all, for the mixed component, something like this. Let me call this N bar, and an equation for the pure components, delta G, M bar, N bar, right? So they are going to be independent. Now, this two metric deformations, the one with the mixed indices and the one with the pure indices. So this is going to, so this is an equation telling you that the thing is harmonic, this deformation, and this is going to define for you an harmonic 1-1 form, right? So something like this, G, m n bar, dx or dz or however you want to call it, dx n bar. So this is an harmonic 1-1 form. Harmonic 1-1 form. Now, this thing over here is going to define a harmonic 2-1 form for you because you're going to contract it. So this is a real thing. You're going to contract it with omega and you get something like alpha, beta, let's say, for example, oops, nu bar, delta t, nu bar, or I'm turning here to Greek indices, whatever, dx alpha wedge dx beta wedge dx nu bar. So this defines for you an harmonic 2-1 form. Harmonic 2-1 form. So and so the number of these forms again is H11, the number of these forms is H21, and they are harmonic. Now, the obvious question is, if we have one kind of this torsional background, what are the deformations of the metric going to be? Now, the problem is, so there are two kinds of problems. First of all, that we have to define this Ricci tensor no longer with respect to the metric G, but we have now this funny connection floating around. So, I mean, we have to be careful on how we define our Ricci tensor over there. In order to say that the mixed and pure components decouple, we have used the fact that this is a Kähler manifold. In case that it's non-Kähler, like the one we are considering here, there is no reason why this should be decoupled. So probably it's not even true that you can talk about complex structure and Kähler structure deformations. So, and what exactly, so over here you're solving, so to say, the Laplace equation, yeah? So you are talking about metric deformations and you're counting solutions of the Laplace equation well, and where the solutions are given by, so the number of solutions, you count them with the Hodge numbers. So what kind of differential equation you're going to get if you consider one of the stores in our background? So we don't know, that's an open question, we're working on it. Yes. Can you please? Yes, there is a superpotential where you can derive the conditions from. Now, it turns out to be a little bit problematic to get that thing from a Kaluza-Klein reduction, because actually there is one of the properties of this kind of background that is good and bad at the same time is that remember that we talked about stabilizing moduli fields in the presence of fluxes. Well, one of the things that you are going to stabilize by using this kind of background is the size. You say, I mean, good. Then you finally are able to explain why we live in four dimensions, right? You say, well, the thing is going to be small. The only problem with that is that in order to use the supergravity approximation, you have to work with a volume that you must be able to make really, really big, so you don't want it stabilized. So it's a little bit, so you can guess a superpotential that leads to the right conditions, but obtaining that from a Kaluza-Klein reduction has turned out to be problematic. More questions? Yes. What induces torsion? The free form or what? The what factor in the metric? The one in the type 2B case. I mean, why don't you just? I mean, this is something that you may be able to check, right? So you look at the supersymmetric transformation. I mean. Well, let's say it this way. I mean, in most compactifications, I would say, with fluxes, people have ignored the role of the warp factor, and this is actually something that should not be done. So usually it turns out that you can show that the warp factor is going to be 1 plus something that is subleading. So for all kind of computations that you do, for example, when I talked yesterday about Calabi-Yau manifold, about Calabi-Yau 4 integrals, right? I mean, I compute integral over xh, right? And I say this is the Euler character. And nowhere I've mentioned any role of any warp factor, right? So the assumption that is implicitly there is that you can have an expansion in the size. And then, so, and you can actually consistently do that. So you make a Taylor expansion in 1 divided by the size, and you can show that the warp factor is subleading. So most people, even Giddings, Kafka, and Polchinski, I mean, they assume that, to leading order, this warp factor can simply be set to 1. But studying properties of the background in the presence of this warp, I mean, it's really important because it can do weird things for you, as we are going to see tomorrow, right? I mean, the warp factor can, for example, become 0, and then something is going to happen to your metric. So you must be really careful. But the assumption that they are using is that it's subleading in the expansion 1 divided by the size. More questions? Well, if not, then let's meet again tomorrow morning at 9:30.